The following Dharma talk was given by Ron Hogan Green. Hogan Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon to each of you here in the Zendo, to those at home or wherever you may be, and to my Dharma brother, who may not be here physically, but is very much here with us. This is the founding session, and I thought it would be appropriate to take up case number one in the transmission of the light, Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was enlightened, and he said, "I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way." There's a poem with this koan. "A splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. In time, obstructing branches flourish everywhere." So this koan from Transmission of the Light, the first koan, and these koans are, there's 53 of them, and each koan is a presentation of the enlightenment story of each of the ancestors from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha through Ajo, who was one generation, I believe, after Dogen. And these koans, it was written in 1300, were put together by Master Keizan, compiled by him. He's, I think, two generations after Dogen. And they're very subtle, profoundly subtle koans. They have a different flavor than many of the other koans. And some don't even seem to be a question. They're just a description of the realization of that ancestor. And in working on these, for me, it was profoundly transforming, because in each koan, you had to come to that same place that that ancestor had come to in order to see into the koan on the face of it. The words and the descriptions didn't reach it at all. And also, I think in the hands of a realized guiding teacher, it's wonderful how they can help you and direct you, but not too much, and allow you to come to this realization yourself. When Shakyamuni Buddha, seeing the morning star, and profoundly awakening, said, "I and the great earth and all sentient beings simultaneously achieve the way." That, to me, is a very interesting statement, because actually, the great earth and all beings had already achieved the way. By their very nature, they've achieved the way. So he's talking about realizing that he himself personally and directly realized what was already there. And this is, I think, a crucial understanding and a question. Can we appreciate this in relation to our own self? That we are inherently whole and complete, inherently a Buddha, and we too have the ability to realize ourselves in our lifetime. And the question I want to explore here is, how is the Buddha speaking of relationship? Because on the face of it, what relationship is he talking about? Daito Roshi, when speaking of relationships, intimate relationships, would say, in intimacy, there is no relationship whatsoever. How can there be? There's nothing outside you. There's no thing, no one to relate to. It is all you. Having realized oneself as the great earth and all beings, what could possibly be apart from that? And yet, here we are, obviously in relationship with each other, and indeed with the earth, all beings, and much, much more. So there might seem to be a contradiction or a tension there. No relationship, relationship. The Heart Sutra helps us here as we practice and gradually realize the Buddha's understanding for ourselves. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And in a way, that could be misunderstood, or not deeply understood, or conceptually understood. But that's not what it's pointing at. Form is emptiness. Each specific form of any type is empty, has no abiding, permanent reality. So we say form, we can conceptualize, well, forms are empty. And you hear that in Zen centers and Buddhist centers. Forms are empty. And all forms are empty. And emptiness is all forms, and each specific form as well. There's nothing outside your enormous body. This is an expression of the Buddha's awakening that Daito Roshi often would say. He would say it personally, there's nothing outside this enormous body, which is really saying what the Buddha was saying. This realization is the wholeness, the nothing left outness of there is not a single thing. And within this realization is that every single thing is unique, whole, and without any lack. So those two statements, there is not a single thing, and each and every single thing is whole, empty, and without any lack, are really the same statement as we begin to sit and appreciate. So when you sit zazen and you forget yourself to whatever extent, where are you? Are you not there? Well, something's there. And yet, what is it? Can you say it? Can you speak? Can you point to it? Of course, you can't point to it. And if you try and express it, blah, 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 it's not quite possible, is it? Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. The vast, limitless emptiness that the Buddha, and if emptiness is a problem for you, no thingness that the Buddha realized can only be realized within form. Can't be realized anyplace else. And so our practice, whether we can appreciate it or not, at any point, is to realize this for ourselves. And yet there is no point, well, I shouldn't say there's no point, but in general, that realization doesn't have any stations. Sometimes it does. There are moments in practice where something happens, and those are crucial and important moments. But there are many more moments when we're just practicing, and somehow, hey, I was thinking, for years I lived in A-frame 3, I think 10 years in that A-frame, and there were the trees and the mountain, and in those 10 years I would often sit on the deck and do zazen or just sit there and look at the mountain, and I never saw the trees grow, And a while ago, I went back, and the trees have obscured the mountain. How did that happen? I never saw it. And that's our practice. We don't get to see it. And yet, we get to live it. And our life is changing, and we know this. So as we practice in letting go of a thought, in concentrating on an inquiry, in being present moment after moment to the best of our ability, on open awareness, we're investigating what our relationship is, what our relationship is to our sense of a separate permanent self. And every time, in some of the practices, that a thought comes up to reify that, we see that, and we let that go. We let go of our construction of a permanent self in that thought. That is so insightful to the truth that there is no permanent self. But we can't think of it that way. This isn't philosophy or religious study. It's direct experience. And so we don't get to cognitively assess it. It doesn't help us to do that. We'd like to measure it, wouldn't we? How am I doing? What's my number, 70, 80? Maybe tomorrow it'll be 100? Or, no, it's 2. We probably do that all the time to ourselves. So we're investigating what our relationship is to a sense of a separate self and to each other. And especially to those we like or dislike, or never consider, or never will encounter directly. This is all in the bag. It's all in play. We should never forget that we're all students of the Buddha. It is from the Buddha's enlightenment that we follow this path to our enlightenment. We are on this path together, in relationship, in this practice. And it's not so important what the particulars are for each individual of how they understand their specific practices. We're all different, and we're all together. And that nourishes and holds us. We are in relationship, deep and profound relationship. Can you do this without me? Because I can't do this without you. Our life is energy. Our form is energy. How do we work with this energy? It is what we have to work with. E equals MC square, right? That's the whole universe. Without energy, there ain't nothing. And I don't mean the Dharma here. Although that's not exempt from the Dharma either. So it's what we have to work with, our energy. And often we think in terms of a more superficial form of working our practice. But at base, it's energy. It's why we start with a breath practice, right? With a concentration practice, usually, to gather that energy, because we've used our energy prior to doing zazen. How have we used it? We all know how we've used it, right? Greed, anger, and delusion is one expression. Taylor Swift football, fill in the blanks of how we've used our energy. Nothing against it, but I don't think it helps address our suffering. I think it perpetuates it. Feelings are one form of energy. So is our intelligence, our thoughts, our physical actions. How we use our energy is how we create our life and how we create our karma. Good things occur if we use our energy wisely, and more energy results that allows us to use our life wisely. Bad things occur, and if we fight and resist, there's a very different result. And yet bad things or good things occur, and if we don't fight and resist, but open our arms to the reality of what is, good things occur. Maybe not what we want, but what's so interesting is putting aside a desire that reflects our vows. What you and I want personally isn't so important in the Dharma. It has some value because we're an individual and we have our individual karma. And so that has an importance, but we're not in control. And so what comes along is ours, always. So our use of our life energy reflects how we are together. And when I was thinking about this, of course, Yukon came to mind. So just sharing some of my impressions and relationships with Yukon. I first met him on a truck. He was on, at that time, a beat up one F-150 Ford that we had here. It was one of my first or second visits to the monastery. He had this big, impressive mustache. And he and I and Dido were on this work crew. Dido was driving the truck because at the time nobody was allowed to use the truck except Dido. And it was instantly apparent he and Dido had this complicated relationship. And it was also interestingly apparent. I mean, one of the things that I knew, or either then or later, is, and he said it at the time, actually, right in the truck, Yukon had this relationship with the monastery where he would be here, then he'd leave, and he'd be here, and then he'd leave. Not quite committed, but not uncommitted. And he said this to Dido, and he said, one day I'll come here. But the manner in which he conducted himself and related to us and to others was as an entertainer. And that made sense. His family extended and was in the entertainment business at a high level. He had a professional voice. If you ever get a chance to hear him speak the final words of Maizumi Roshi in the CD One Way Ticket, I don't know if we still have that. I'm getting a nod. I would invite you to listen to it. It's at the very end, and I listen to it every couple of months because it just goes right into me. That's Yukon. That is Yukon. But at that time, he was an entertainer, and that was his presentation to the world. And that's needed to be his presentation to the world. He had lived a very eventful life. He had worked in a hospice in California with dying people and other events of his life, which were dramatic and traumatic. So there was that. And then there was the entertainer. And that created an effect. And then he came into residency. And he went on the monastic path. But it wasn't easy for him. I remember when he was training to be liturgist. He was the only liturgist who sung. He didn't chant, he sang. And it would drive Dreamont crazy, as I recall, trying to get him away from the microphone, so to speak, and to chant the chants So that was his energy, and it was out there. And yet he was completely committed over time to Dharma practice, and therefore had to address that energy in a way that was much more useful to bring forth his vows into his life. And so that transformation, understanding that nothing transformed, it was all there from the beginning, was remarkable. Same energy, same big personality, but now completely within the Dharma. And it was honest, deeply honest, deeply real. And he obviously affected people, large numbers of people in a very positive way. You do too. As you practice, even if you don't practice, you affect people. And affect them in a very different way as you do practice. And again, it's like watching the trees grow. Where does that happen? How does that happen? There's no credit to the tree for it growing. There's no credit for us when we live out of that Dharma path, out of manifesting, out of turning in a way towards the Dharma that is not self-reflective, that becomes natural, partially because we're so desperate to live a true life, to become our true self, which we already are, but have carefully hidden away from ourselves. In the third turning of the Dharma wheel, the first turning is about the Buddha's fundamental teaching, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. The second is about emptiness and other aspects. The third, karma. There's more to it than that. The Buddha speaks of the lion's roar. The roar is the fearless proclamation that anything that happens in our state of mind, that happens to us, be it emotion, feeling, events, health, lack of health, conflict, is the ground that we can awaken on. And to me, this is fundamental. To me, having taken up deeply the practice of the cultivation of stillness, of the cultivation of zazen and insight, of a commitment to living a compassionate life for ourselves and others. What happens when the shit hits the fan? When it ain't what you want, like, welcome, or have any possibility of doing that? And you know what? It will. It's going to happen. If you live long enough. So the lion's roar is the teaching that whatever comes is workable. My expression of that is to turn my life toward the Dharma. That whatever comes, I turn it towards the Dharma. I don't want to. It's a lot easier to be resentful, angry, justify myself, be reactive. And I do all of those things. And then I pause. And I say, oh, shit, I did it again. And that hurts. What holds me is my vows. Not just saying them or feeling at the time when I say them that I mean them. This is when the vows matter. When it ain't what I want. Trungpa Rinpoche, speaking of this, says, we begin to realize that all kinds of chaotic situations that might occur in our life, will occur in our life, are opportunities. They're workable. And we should not reject them and not regard them as a going back to a confused way of understanding ourselves and others, which is how the ordinary life is, a confused way of understanding oneself and others. Indeed, we must develop, he says, a profound respect for those situations that happen in our state of mind. So we're dealing with our mind. Can we imagine that? I mean, it's easy to imagine when that neutral or good things come along. Can we imagine that whatever our mind produces, and that we can honor and respect whatever it is? That doesn't mean following what we encounter in our mind blindly. It does mean simply to appreciate our mind, our conditioning, our karma, our intelligence, our desire to awaken. And with this appreciation, our klesas, our anxieties, our neuroses, our crazinesses that we all have, all of it becomes useful to us, part of the package. That's the transformation that I pointed at with Yukon. From the entertainer to someone who welcomed everybody with a joyful heart and communicated that. We got that. We got that from him. He offered it. It wasn't phony. It wasn't, well, I'm going to be nice with a fake smile. It was instantly recognizable as genuine. And he was a person. And he too, like us, had to deal with the challenges of being a person, a human being. And yet, in turning to the Dharma this way, our nascent Buddha nature comes forth and is invigorated and trusted. And when we feel threatened emotionally, our responses of aggression or retreat or hiding from ourselves sometimes that we don't even know. Have you ever had the experience that you just won't see something in yourself? Sometimes you won't even physically see something. Not because it's the thought of that is so threatening. It's just so threatening that it doesn't exist for us. Or perhaps we're become very clever or aggressive in a very passive way and manipulative. And yet, if we can stand in the storm of ourself, which means taking up whatever bit of awareness that we can manifest, then something remarkable happens. A crack occurs that we can enter. It's one of the reasons our relationship with Sangha is so crucial. I can't see my dark side. I remember when Daito would tell the story early in his days of photography, and he would show his photographs and ask, how do you feel, how do you feel, how do you feel? Which is a way that we work with that. And he kept getting the response, well, it's very sexual. It's very sexual. And go, what? What are you talking about? There's no sex there. You know, when 10 people tell you that, there's sex there. You're not seeing it. Well, thank you. Thank you for when you offer that to me. Because I can't do this without you. I can't see what I'm blind to. And so to stand in that storm, to consider the possibilities of what the Sangha offers you, is the heart of relationship. And that comes out of the wisdom of the Buddha, that among our apparent differences is a unity that is whole. This is not easy. It's not easy for anybody. It takes time. Perhaps a slow, deliberate study of ourself, to arrive at a place where we can at least entertain even the possibility of being open to ourselves. It takes an understanding that there's no quick fixes in this practice, that we have to attend to the details of the ways that we harm ourselves and others over time and with care and with trust, trust in the Dharma, trust in the Sangha, trust in our teachers, trust in ourselves. And as you trust this path, you find, interestingly enough, that within that vulnerability, you are invulnerable. You can do that. We will die. Each individual here will die. As did you, Khan, as will I. And yet, to trust this life that is taking us to our death offers a remarkable, beyond remarkable freedom to live in the present moment, to deeply understand that in this moment we are unborn and undying, and therefore have that freedom to be present, because there is no threat. There's nothing that can harm us. And so we're turning towards the Dharma in this way, particularly at a time when we feel we just can't. Our relations between our custom sense of ourself and the person of true compassion that we are begins to open up. We become willing to dance, to flow with our life, no matter what direction the tide is going. And whatever direction it is, we are here with it, encountering our true heart, encountering the full energy of our life. We have given ourselves permission to open our heart and give it all away. And does that mean we get nothing back? No. In a strange and wonderful way, in giving it all away, you get a joyful life. The particulars may or may not be exactly what we want. Often they're not. Because what we want is self-centered, right? But our vows are not self-centered. The willingness to meet ourselves in the midst of our anxieties and fears, and to hold them up to be seen as kind of temporary karmic accretions that ultimately have no power unless we give them power, and no energy unless we give them energy. It's so interesting that often, you know, just one small example, the energy of having a lot of money often is that you want more money. Now, for me, the energy of having a piece of chocolate cake is that I want to eat that and have another piece of chocolate cake. But it's the same energy. It's the same stupidity. It's the same harm. So this lion's roar, this willingness to turn towards whatever it is that comes our way within the realm of samsara, within this ordinary realm of suffering, is simply that dharmically this works. This is useful. This helps you and me. And if we choose not to do that, just patch it over with distraction, with flashy things that attract us, with what we're used to, then not much happens dharmically. A lot is happening karmically. So this is what we face in practice. And luckily, We face it over and over and over and over again because we're conditioned in particular ways. So the antibody-antigen reaction of how our conditioning meets what we most fear always comes. It always will find us. And each time, usually, we have the challenge of it and the opportunity of it. And, you know, the Buddha faced this. You know, when he sat down under the tree the night before his awakening, and Mara appeared. And who is Mara? We all know Mara. Mara's our buddy, right? Mara is an aspect, an important aspect of ourself. And Mara said, "Who the fuck do you think you are? You think you're the Buddha?" And what did the Buddha do? Put his hand on the ground. He put it on the ground, which is the whole earth, all beings, and you and I. A splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. At the same time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. There's a lot of ways to look at that very short poem. The splendid branch is the life, the Buddha's life, and the Buddha's enlightenment. That comes from the old plum tree, from our inherent nature. And at the same time, obstructive thorns, the relative world, the wheel of samsara, is present and flourishes. It has to, they're the same. They're in relationship, just like you and I. All our life is relationship. That's what we got to work with. We're entwined. We're part and parcel of each other. And we dance together. And we enormously affect each other. And enormously affect so many more beings than we are aware of. Sometimes it becomes obvious. Just look at the wall downstairs of cards, letters, poems, pictures. But mostly we don't know. In this practice, we're invited to see, to open our eyes, to see how we affect each other, and especially how what we think and do and say affects our life. Because how our life is affected affects other lives. So it's important. And these obstructive thorns, yes, they obstruct. Yes, there's enormous suffering in the world. But they're also opportunity. We can turn towards them. We can't get rid of them, so we might as well use them to help ourselves, to help others. That the specific circumstances of these obstructions offer us a way in. And these obstructive thorns, as we grow more skillful in using them, become the path of our awakening. Isn't that ironic? What we thought would hold us back is an invitation to go forward. This room and the people I know closely is littered with that example. When the Buddha touched the ground and touched us and our life, he was inviting you to touch the same ground, inviting you to trust your life, inviting you to take another step, the step in front of you, whatever that may be. That's your job to decide that. But to take it, and to take it with a vow and intent to help, for which you are fully equipped. It is a given.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.